Good morning and welcome to Sport and Life with Sam Kekovic and Leon Wigard with the compliments of Mitchell and Wine. Now, hello, Sam.
Hi, Leon. How are you?
Now, I got a strange phone call.
Elaborate.
For a listener to this podcast, his name is Phil Bolton. Phil Bolton was a very, very good golfer, a very fine coach down in the Mornington Peninsula mainly. He now lives up at Cobbamburuga.
Right.
He rang to say how much he enjoys the program.
Good.
And he said, just remind Sam of when he was selling cars for a bloke named Vin in Rosebud.
Yes.
And Vin's name was not Vin Kelly or something. It was Vin something, his boxing name. Is this a memory for you?
No, it's not. I did sell cars, but that was for Peter Moody. Not Peter Moody, our Peter Moody. What's her name? The Moody's from Rye.
Yeah, that's the same group. Well, close enough. Rosebud.
Yeah, Rosebud, yeah.
Well, there was a Vin.
The yard was in Rosebud, but I was at Rye at the time.
Oh, well, Vin Gelleratus or something, but his name was, he changed his name to Vin something anglicised.
Right, okay.
And he was a former boxer.
Right.
But to you, Phil, good morning to you up there in Baruga.
Indeed so, Phil.
Sam's memories are sort of shaking in the gear.
Well, no, they were good. Yards. I was coached at Rye for a year there. They were terrific memories and the car yard
Oh,
was,
yes, you coached there, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, and I had a Moody's Motel, I always remember.
Oh, well, the Moody. Now, that guy married a water polo girl.
Ah.
For Moody's, the son of the original founder. Yeah, yeah. And they're in everything now, building and...
I know, they're huge. Yeah. Huge, and that's how it all started. And he had a little small car yard, you know, used cars at Rosebud, and that was sort of my mode of employ for a while. Yeah, I only had about half a dozen cars and, you know, but it was a lot of fun times.
Well, this might ring a bell. You ring this bloke, Vin. You're supposed to have been at work and you didn't get there for some reason. And he said, listen, Vin, while we're having a chat, you want to have a game of cards? And you're playing cards on the phone. And he like said, hey, how can I win? I don't know what you've got.
I think I went and bought some cars. I bought a couple of cars, I think, at Frankston Auctions. And I don't know, there was a hassle over a couple of prizes, over sale of a couple of hundred either way, you know, by wholesale or read, no, we're this way. So I said, I'll tell you what we'll do, we'll play a game, play a show and tell, you know, for the difference.
Anyway, that was it. Good morning, Phil.
Yeah.
We'll be back very shortly with the wonderful Craig Parry, who is a wonderful golfer, of course, with a terrific record, right after this. Now we welcome to the Sport and Life podcast, Craig Parry. Craig Parry, known to all Australian sports people, turned pro as a golfer in 1985, won 23 big events in a star-studded career.
Two PGA events.
And probably the most famous shot he played ever was at Royal Melbourne, and I was there that day in the crowd. By the way, the crowd has swelled to 100,000 now. I saw that shot in the President's Cup. George is now. G'day, Craig.
How are you, guys?
Two famous shots of yours, that one at Royal Melbourne and the other one when you won the event in America where you and your brother had a stash about what you should use.
Exactly, and he was correct. I was wrong.
That was the Ford, wasn't it?
The Ford Championship at Doral.
Doral, that's it.
Monster.
200 yards out, you picked that. What was it? What club did you use?
Five.
I used a 6-iron. I wanted to use 5-iron. And my brother said, no, I think you'll get there with a 6-iron. And he was correct.
And it got as close as you can get.
In the hole.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we're in South Florida, which has a lot of people from South America. And they were actually barracking for me versus barracking for the American player, which is really unusual to have in America. Normally when you're going up against the American players, obviously they're the ones that get all of the crowd support. But in Miami, it was actually for me.
And I might add, whilst you're on that, being lauded, I do recall vividly when you're on top of your game then, I remember in the Masters, I think it was the Masters, you led the third round and then you incurred their wrath. They were trying to put you off your game and trying to help the American.
Yeah, well, what happened on that day, we had to come back and finish our third round on the Sunday morning.
That's right.
Was quite a warm Sunday. So the public are in early and obviously they're having a few sherbets. And by the time we tee off late in the afternoon, they really wanted three couples to win. And
that's right.
You know, they got, you know, pretty vocal in the way they were carrying on. And Davis Love actually said to me after the event the following week, he said, look, don't take it personally. He said, the same thing happened to me in LA Open. And, you know, that's a fellow American player. The same thing happened to. So, look, if Baker Finch or I had been paired together, I think one of us might have actually had a chance of winning the Masters,
yeah.
But it was never to be. He played with Ray Floyd and I played with couples.
Do you recall, because I remember that pretty vividly now, you really got annoyed a couple of times. You really, you know, you got your back up. I don't know if you vented your spleen to the extent where you inflicted a tirade of invective upon the masses, but you certainly, there was a couple of expletives there.
I thought they were under my best.
I think I can read you. I can lip read you.
You can read lips. Yeah, look, it's just one of those things. And, you know, looking back, if I had the President's Cup experience, I would have been able to handle it a lot better. Previously, you know, there was no President's Cup in those days. And, you know, you only ever had people barracking for you. You didn't have people barracking against it. It's totally different when you get in that scenario. And, you know, if you had the President's Cup, you know, a little bit older, I think I might have been able to handle it a bit better. But, you know, it wasn't to be. So, no drama. I had an opportunity at the Masters to, you know, get my name on the trophy, but wasn't good enough.
Now, if I can go back, and a bit self-indulgent here, 24 years, 1999, Carnoustie, which will bring back some great memories and not so great for you. I was sitting, we had a group of golfers there. We decided to go there on the last day. And the idea was we'd walk around the course and have a look at the general pin placements and all that and get into the grandstand at the final hole for the last day. So we were sitting in the front row near the burn.
Yep.
And I thought, no, we shouldn't be in the front row because the railing gets in your eyesight. So we went back to the second row. So we're sitting there watching all the players come through. Finally, you come through with Vandeveld, who had an unbeatable lead, as we all know, the famous Frenchman that sprayed his drive, hit it into the grandstand.
Into the pond.
Got a very unfortunate bounce right in front of us, bounced back over the burn into long grass, into the burn, and then finished up in a replay. Now, the Craig Parry story was, what did you actually say what I thought you said to him when he took his shoes and socks off, rolled his pants up, and was working out whether he could hit a shot from out of the water?
I said if he played it a bit quicker, he would have been able to get it in there before the tide had come.
That's
in.
That's right.
And he could have played it out. He took so long to actually get around to get into the hazard, the burn. The water was rushing in. When I first arrived, only half the ball was actually buried. By the time he actually got around and get into the hazard, the ball was completely buried.
It's
but he could have actually played it out because he was far enough back from the wall. You know, professional golfers, you know, they've got the ability to actually hit it out of that water. That's fine. We just don't get to do it all that often. And obviously with, you know, the lead you had in the Open, you're probably not going to do it.
But the story didn't finish there because Craig Parry's story was lost in all of that. You actually holed the shot out of the bunker to miss the playoff by one shot.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it was just one of those things. Our balls were next to each other in the bunker and I had the first bunker shot because it was the first one that we actually got to. And I held my bunker shot for a birdie and there'd be one out of the playoff in the end. And I said to John, you know, follow me into the hole, and he headed out and then hold his five-footer to get in his playoff. You know, it was one of the saddest things I've ever probably seen in golf. And, you know, a lot of the commentators actually didn't understand that we were playing into a slight breeze and it was actually raining, you know, just that really light mist.
And cold.
And you don't pick that up on the TV, and it was getting cooler. And, you know, when he hit it into the rough after his second shot where it came across the burn, what happens when the rough gets really wet, the club gets caught in the rough and it'll just turn over on you, and, you know, you got out of bounds straight to the left. And it's just one of those things that, you know, one thing led to another, and, you know, he ended up losing the Open.
You had 6 wins in Europe over a long time. Did you prefer Europe than America?
My game was more suited to America. To Europe versus America. The reason I went to America was to go and play against the best players in the world. And, you know, there was obviously more prize money in America as well, but my game was actually suited to Europe.
So, Craig, tell me, the European Tour, your card to qualify, the European card was applicable to the American tournaments as well in those days, or do you have to qualify for the American card to get a...
That was separate. So you had a European Tour card, and the better players from the European Tour got invited to play the majors in America, or even the weeks before, they gave exemptions to the European players to come across, which was really good. I mean, the tour worked extremely well back in the 90s and even the 2000s, and it's only the last little period that it's, you know, been up in the air on about who's playing in what events and you know, who's on what tour and how's it all working. And look, it's just one of those things. I was lucky to play against the best players in the world when I was playing tournament golf. You know, Tiger was unbelievable. And I got to play with Nicklaus in his last round on the PGA Tour at Nomura, which is, you know...
That'd be a treasured moment in time.
Absolutely. He beat me by a shot, which is even better than the story, but he gave me his golf ball when we finished. So I asked him for his golf ball and he signed the ball. So I've got that at home. This is just Jack.
Fantastic. Tell me, Craig, one of the most polarising figures in golf, it's amazing, this story, is Greg Norman. Greg Norman's probably done more for golf in Australia than any other individual. And even on a global stage, you know, winning all the tournaments, and yet he's never recognised. I don't know whether it's self-inflicted or, you know, whether it's deserved. But he's never been quite accorded the recognition, and I think it's irked him to this stage. What's your take on Norman?
Norman has done a lot for world golf, you know, over the years. What he's done with this world tour, I don't think has really helped his legacy.
The Live Tour.
It's shown how greedy the golfers are, and, you know, him being a part of it, I don't think it's actually done him any favours, because, you know, obviously his record stands by itself. I mean, you know, the record number one player at the time, so many weeks number one in the world, winning tournaments all over the world. A lot of players only win in one area or one region, whereas Greg was able to win in all different regions. And, you know, he took the game to another level before Tiger come along, and we played for a lot more prize money because of Greg.
Yeah, and I think the fact that... But see, the fact he never won a major on American soil, I think has always been, you know, biting at him. And the fact that he, you know, when he took over at Live, the Live Tour, I think the fact that he's never quite accepted by the establishment as per se, I think also has irked him. And he's never been the voice. You look at a Faldo, you look at others that have, you know, aspired to, you know, greatness in terms of after the event. Norman has never been really accepted in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the media more so than anyone.
Yeah.
You know, look, the media can be very good for you or they can be really cruel. And, you know, it's just a matter of the relationship that you have with the media. I always thought you give people the time that they gave you. And, you know, I found that I had a really good relationship with the media, and, you know, you give the interviews when they need the interviews, and, you know, because they need a story as well. And, you know, maybe it was, he was just fed up with giving interviews and you know, being Mr. Nice Guy.
Now, Craig, getting back to your career, Victorian born, of course, and Sunshine, Medway. There's a good reason why you then went to Western Australia.
Yeah, my father worked for ICI Explosives, which was at Deer Park, and he was travelling all over Australia and, you know, had the opportunity to go to WA and be based in Fremantle or just down south of Fremantle. And, you know, that way he was more at home rather than travelling all over Australia. So we moved across to WA when I was 16 after I'd finished school at the Sunshine Tech School. And which was made famous in the movie The Castle. That's where the daughter goes off to the TAFE. That was the school I actually went to. And, you know, I went over to WA and I joined Royal Fremantle, a very good, strong golf club in Western Australia, and loved playing there and played state golf and then, you know, played for Australia and before I turned pro.
What course was that, Craig?
Royal Fremantle.
Royal Fremantle.
So they've had a lot of good players come through there over the time, and you know, it's just a really good golf course on the top of the hill at Fremantle.
My word! So, and when was the first big break into the international scene?
I won the TPC, the Canadian TPC, about a month before I won the New South Wales Open, which was a big event back here in Australia. I played with Trevino and Roger Davis at the time. And the final round, and you know, that was two events that really kicked me off and going, and that was back in 87. So I turned pro in December 85, and then, you know, I was really only out there for a year before learning my trade and, you know, winning tournaments and, you know, giving the opportunity to go and play in bigger events. And once you get the door open, you need to take that opportunity, and I was fortunate enough I was able to do that.
Now, they told me some of the pros didn't like playing with Trevino because it was too hard to concentrate.
Yeah, it is very hard because he's always cracking jokes to the spectators. I like playing with Lee, and when I went across on the Champions Tour to play with the 50-year-olds, I actually seen him at one of the events and we caught up, and you know, he remembered that we played back when I was only, you know, 20 years of age, you know, 30-odd years ago. And, you know, he's a really nice guy.
Tell me, did you ever have a round with Tiger?
Yeah, I played with Tiger when he was 17 in the Scottish Open. He lived in our same area in Alworth. He was a member of the club that I was a member at, and used to play and practice with Tiger quite a lot.
Did you ever think he'd aspire to the heights that he did? Was it visible or evident in those days?
He was another level. When he hit balls down the practice range, the dispersion of balls around the target zone, you knew that Tiger had actually been down there. You know, he could hit a 3-iron inside our pitching wedges. And, you know, his ability to hit all different shots and, you know, was just remarkable. And we were practicing one day and we would call the shots and he was struggling to hit a high draw on the 3-wood. And I said, well, look, if you can't hit it, no one in the planet can hit it. What are you worried about? Just hit it up there and hit it on the green. He's like, yeah, good idea.
I remember having a chat with Paul Gale once on the I just wanted to have an idea or an insight into some of the personalities on the tour. And it was interesting enough, I was always a great fan of Mickelson's. You know, the report. Yeah. You know where I'm heading. I couldn't believe when he sort of, you know, let loose on Mickelson. I thought, how could he be so popular going around? Or the crowd loved him, the New Yorkers loved him. I thought, he must be a terrific bloke. Well, Paul, eh?
How the media builds someone up. I've never met you, right, heroes or something like that, isn't it?
Oh, not only that. Paul Gale was saying he was at the table once, during a lunch break or something, and you know, Mickelson as much as said, listen, son, this is not a table for you. You better bolt over the other side. He said he was just nothing that you would have thought he was like. He was, you know, one of the most crass guys on the tour. You wouldn't believe it.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. Yeah, I've got stories as well. I mean, you know, the thing is, I'm sure all the players on the PGA Tour have got a story about Phil, and he's just a different. He runs to his own beat, and you know, he's just different.
Yeah, and Craig, the other thing he mentioned, though, which was surprising, he said, "I can't believe the enormity of the tour." He said, "When I went to my locker," he said, "there was about 5 dozen balls there. There was about, you know, uniforms, golf clubs, whatever you wanted." He said, "It was so vast." He said, "You know, I'm just a, you know, I was used to just having my own bag and, you know, away I went."
Yeah, but the PGA Tour is another level. Anything that you require is done for you. They even take your laundry to the golf course and then they do your laundry.
But not only that, and the price and money, you said the price,
the amount of tickets for, I remember I was playing in Vegas one time and the Western Bulldogs of the Footscray team had a team holiday over there, and I went and got 40 tickets for the guys to come out to the tournament.
The tournament.
And when I went and spoke to the tournament official, I said, "Look, I need 40 tickets this week." And I said, "We're not going to give you 40 tickets." I said, "Look, it's like your NFL team coming across." And I said, "Yeah, there's 40 tickets, so the boys come out." So anything you require on the tour is done.
And the other thing that was surprising when talking to him is the enormity of the superannuation scheme that they've got there. You know, we're talking about what players earn. He said, "Tiger, whatever Tiger's earned in terms of prize money or endorsements," he said, "you can triple that with your superannuation payout in due course."
Yeah, it's the best in professional sport, they say. And look, I haven't played the PGA Tour since 2007, and you know, I'm living in Australia getting a pension from the PGA Tour. It's a pretty good deal.
I'll say it's a good deal.
Appleby, Allenby, those sorts of guys, they're sitting on a fortune.
Yeah.
Oh, look, any of the guys that played the PGA Tour for a number of years are doing quite well for themselves.
Now, just on another side to you, Craig, I got to know you reasonably well, of course, through your great work with the Palliative Care outfit in the Western Suburbs. It just emphasises what sports people can bring to society. And you did a wonderful job with that really sad thing, isn't it, Palliative Care?
Mm.
Yeah, look, it's very sad. And my grandmother went through it over in WA. And, you know, that was my affiliation of palliative care and how it all started. And we did it for 21 years in the Western Suburbs and, you know, at Medway, Beringal and at Sunshine, where we took the tournament and, you know, tried to raise as much money for the palliative care that we could at the time. And, you know, all the different sportsmen from all the different codes come and supported us. It was absolutely fantastic.
Now, Popeye, tell me something else I'm confused, because you can tell by my questioning that I'm a frustrated golfer, I'm a hacker. But I love the game.
So am I now.
No, I wouldn't say that. But why is it, why do people overcomplicate our game? Now, you're a great classic in point. Your swing, you know, you've lost your swing, you became rather corpulent or rotund, you got it back when you put a few kilos on. Why, you know, you talk about the yips with Baker Finch, you talk about guys that, you know, draws and they do this, and is that they overcomplicate matters? I mean, say, see ball, hit ball.
Yeah, exactly, Sam. It's like any sport. People tend to overcomplicate it, think about it too much when it's really quite basic. Ball from A to B, into the hole, least amount of shots. Don't try and do something you can't do. And that's really the best way to describe it. I mean, in your practice, you're always preparing the same you would play in the tournaments and get yourself ready that way. But if you did all the practice, you know, when you got to the tournament, it was a lot easier to be prepared because you knew what you were going to expect.
Talking about the swing, did you feel more comfortable with a slight fade rather than a draw like most of the pros would play as a stock shot?
A lot of my peers would have said it would have been a slice rather than a fade, and I couldn't even write draw on a piece of paper. So I never had to worry about the left side of the golf course. It was always left to right.
Yeah, but the conventional sort of wisdom is that a draw will always get you further down the fairway, of course.
Yeah, but the problem with a draw is you never know when it's going to stop.
Exactly.
Whereas the fade, you always knew that it was going to stop pretty quick.
Well,
that's the advantage.
That's right. They get themselves into trouble. They hit through fairways. They nip them quickly to the left. And anyway, that's an interesting thing. But most people who had a left-right shot would try and change it to a draw. But you didn't bother about that.
I tried at different points. And, you know, it's some parts of my career, it did work, but it wasn't a strength. There's no way in the world I could ever call it a strength. And I was just more suited to hit it left or right. I knew where it was going to land, where it was going to finish within a very small area. Whereas when I went right to left, it could go longer. It was just not very consistent. So, you know, I was fortunate. I lacked ability and I didn't have that shot.
Stop being humble, all right? It's not accepted.
Now, Sam, you want this bloke on your side in a crush?
Oh, would you ever?
You know what his record is in European golf in playoffs? 3 wins, no losses in playoffs.
Does it come in any surprise? That nitty gritty, tenacious Western suburbs bulldog approach. Cool. And Popeye, tell me something. What was the incentive? What was the motivation behind all of a sudden after the bright lights, you went into golf, designing golf courses?
Yeah, I've been doing golf course design work mainly here in Sydney. I did work with Phil Ryan and Pacific Coast Design out at Mount Derriman. We moved the course across the road to the hill there. But a lot of the courses that I look after are in New South Wales, up the Northern Beaches, up to Ballina. Teevan were the first 9 holes in the top 100 in Australia, which is an amazing little golf course. 9 holes, you play 2 different tees. The front 9 is quite easy. The back 9 is really, really hard. And you play into the same greens and you go, wait a second, what happened here? And, it's a lot of fun, but it's just a great course. Got platypus in the river. It's pretty unique and you've got a rainforest on one of the sides of the hole, so it's pretty cool. And I've got about 20 courses that I look after at the moment.
Oh, well, that'll keep you busy. And you did Sunshine, of course.
That with Pacific Coast Design, and that was early days. And 2005, I think we opened up, and we were down there, moving soil around, and we've designed a really good golf course for all levels of golfers, and that's one of the harder things to do, have it so you can have a championship, but also the members can go out and enjoy it.
What about that other great passion of yours, that fishing? What's the size of your boat now? It was an 80-footer when I first met you. You probably had to be 130.
No. Don't let the facts get in the way of a story.
It's called the Queen Mary.
Oh.
I actually used to go scuba diving. And I loved going down and actually watching the fish rather than catching them and taking my viewing pleasure away. So I used to go scuba diving more so than fishing.
Ah, God, scuba diving. Can you imagine Popeye in a suit going down below?
Oh, I can. He's an all-around sports guy. Hey, Craig, we better get one lesson from you.
Yep.
What's the secret about a putt you've got to get? One like a downhill left to right, for a championship point. What's the secret to it all?
It's all in the mindset. The putt doesn't change from when you practice your putting on the putting green to out on the tournament. It doesn't know that it's for the championship. So what you have to actually do is say, okay, what's this putt going to do? And that's the only thing you need to worry about. Pick the highest point and hit the putt at the right speed and you're going to have a chance of making it. And, when you're putting and you've got a putt for $1 million, the putt doesn't know it's for $1 million, only you put that pressure on yourself. So you have to remove that and actually just get back to basics.
Now, Craig, finally, we talk about, when we talk of sport, any endeavour, we talk about the most important issue, and that is the one of integrity. Now, no doubt, if I was just speaking to Leon, Leon's, you know, toured the world playing golf with some very colourful characters whose scorecard has never quite matched the amount of shots that they've played. So what I'm alluding to is in the game of professional golf, there are one or two names that invariably pop up every now and again when it comes to ethics. Have you ever come across any of those?
Not really. You hear stories, and it's just more so hearsay from other players. And look, you know, until I see it, I'm not going to say anything.
No, none of us do, because it's only subjective. But it certainly has its ugly face every now and again when you mention a couple of names. I remember in most recent times, when was that? It was out of the bunker, wasn't it? They alleged that he moved the ball, or what was his name?
Reed.
No, Reed, yeah, he won the Masters. That's right.
Well, what about the Bulldog player, Jason Ackermanis?
Oh, well, no, that's...
No, he's Brisbane Lion.
He's Brisbane Lion.
Now, before we get ourselves into trouble here, yeah, you can't start throwing allegations around.
No, allegedly there was these names.
Oh, well, that's fair enough.
Well, the one with Vijay Singh was always
Make sure you cover your ass, for goodness sake.
Well, allegedly, you know, Craig would know better than I do, but...
Oh, Craig,
I thought he diplomatically handled that one. That's why he fobbed me off like as I was fucking last.
On the more, more about Craig Parry before we finish. So you started in Victoria, went to Western Australia, spent a lot of time in America, even more time in Europe. So you're a world traveller. Then the big decision to move to Sydney. What was all that about?
Yeah, my wife was from Sydney, and I moved to Sydney in 1988. Because we're travelling all over the world, and it's much easier to get flights out of Sydney to Japan, America, and Europe.
Well, with Qantas.
Than it is out of Perth.
With Qantas?
It was with Qantas. I was a very low flyer, and, you know, I love my flying with Qantas, and, you know, hopefully they get back to where they were.
Chairman's Club?
No. I was the business class lounge, which is more than enough for me.
Yes, and you're talking to a complete consumer here. And by the way, very few people buy their way into those things, but Sam does. Craig, it's a great joy having you on our program. Thanks for that.
No worries, Leo.
More strength to you, and we'll catch up to you real soon.
All right. Thanks, guys. Thanks for the interview.
Thanks, Craig. Fantastic.
We'll see you next week, folks, on Sport and Life.